The legislative branch in California has incredible power to introduce and pass bills affecting day-to-day life in the state. But this process is not void of ways for you to get involved, to hold your representatives accountable, and to make your voice heard. I'm your host, Tess Abraham, and we will cover in depth California's legislative process and more on this episode of the California Conversation. Before diving into understanding what's on the ballot this election, I thought it would be first helpful to you to understand how the legislative process works in California. This process can be confusing, but I think it can be broken down into three main areas. We can look at a big picture overview of the California legislature, including who makes up the legislature and what its main responsibilities are. Then we can move to the process for how legislation is passed, answering the question of how does a bill become law? And lastly, we should discuss where your vote plays a role in the process and how you're able to engage in it even when bills are passed without your vote. Just as a note before we dive in, this episode will contain a lot of details that, quite frankly, can be a bit dry. So just hang in there with me. I'll do my best to keep it interesting and engaging. And if you want more detail than what we cover in this episode, all of my research and sources are compiled in an article with the same title as this episode on my website, thecaliforniaconversation.com. So please go there to reference where I'm pulling all of this information from, as well as if you want resources to read more in depth about the process on your own. I cite a ton of resources there to be fully transparent about the work that I'm doing in my research. So just wanted to note that as a resource for you. Now, let's dive into the big picture, high-level overview. Who makes up the California legislature? The legislature is made up of two houses. It's made up of the Senate and the Assembly, and I'm sure you're familiar with that structure because it mirrors the Senate and the House of Representatives at the federal level. The Senate has fewer members who serve longer terms, while the Assembly has more members who serve shorter terms. And having both houses really keeps the priorities and agendas in check so that not every senator and every Assembly person is up for election at the same time or is even serving for the same term. The Senate can focus on longer-term goals, while the Assembly can work more in the short term. Let's start with looking at the details of the Senate. The Senate in California has a total of 40 senators who each serve 4-year terms, and this breaks down so that each one represents about roughly 950,000 residents of the state. Currently, there's a supermajority for the Democratic Party, and this is evidenced by the split of 31 Democrats to 9 Republicans. And actually, a fun fact on that split, as I was recording this episode, Senator Marie Alvarado Gill of District 4 switched political parties. So originally, it was a 32-8 split, and now it's 31-9. Now, you may have noticed that you aren't voting on all 40 Senate positions each election, and that's for a few reasons. The first reason is that you vote by district, so you'll most likely see one Senate position for your specific district on your ballot. Another reason is that elections are split so that not all 40 senators are running at the same time. Senators who represent odd-numbered districts are elected during presidential election years, while senators who represent even-numbered districts are elected in the midterm election years. So for example, I live in Northern LA County, specifically District 27, and so my ballot will have candidates running for the state Senate position for District 27. However, if you live closer to LA proper, you might fall in an even-numbered district, and so you wouldn't see a state Senate position on your ballot until the midterm in 2026. I'll go ahead and link a district map in the show notes so that you can see which district you fall into and what positions you're voting on in November. Senators are assigned to be on various policy committees within the Senate based on their areas of knowledge and expertise. So when a bill goes through the legislative process, it's presented before a policy committee based on its subject matter. And that's where the senators who are knowledgeable on that topic discuss the bill and its policy implications. These policy committee appointments are made by a chosen leader of the Senate known as the president pro tempore. And this president is voted into the position by all 40 senators. Some of these committees include topics like agriculture or housing or the Judiciary Committee and so on. There's 22 of them in total for the Senate, and each would hear bills related to those specific topics. Lastly, in the case of a tie vote in the Senate, the lieutenant governor, who's second in line after the governor, acts as the president of the Senate and would be the tiebreaker. If a bill doesn't have a tied vote, then the lieutenant governor doesn't vote on the bill. Now, switching to the Assembly in California has a total of 80 members, and each serves for 2 years rather than four in the Senate. The Assembly also has a supermajority for the Democratic Party, and this split has 62 Democrat members, 17 Republicans, and one vacancy. You will see candidates for the Assembly on your ballot, both in the presidential election years and the midterms, because they're elected every 2 years, regardless of the even or odd-numbered districts. The Assembly also has policy committees, similar to the Senate, and those appointments are made by the leader of the Assembly, who's the Assembly Speaker, which might sound familiar if you've heard of the Speaker of the House at the federal level. The Assembly has 33 policy committees, consisting of similar subjects as the Senate. A key difference from the Senate, though, is that in the Assembly, if a proposed bill reaches a tie vote, the initiative is just dropped. So there's no tiebreaker like the lieutenant governor in the Senate. Overall, what do the Senate and the Assembly do? Well, their responsibilities as the legislature is to introduce and pass legislation, and that's specifically done in the form of bills. I didn't realize just how many bills are proposed and passed each legislative session, which, just as a note, a legislative session is every 2 years. The bills that are introduced is just a crazy amount. Thousands of bills are authored and presented every session because the Assembly allows each member to introduce a maximum of 50 bills every 2 years, and the Senate similarly allows 40 bills per member. Obviously, not all of these pass, as they require a majority vote in both houses, but there were close to 1,000 bills officially passed through the legislature for the last session. Speaking of passing legislation, how does that process work? Proposing a bill and ultimately getting it through the legislature to the governor's desk can be broken down into 5 steps. Each bill starts as an idea, and an idea can be proposed by anyone. The bills ultimately have to be authored either by a senator or an assembly person, but they can get these ideas from interest groups or just a concerned citizen. Once they decide to run with an idea, they'll send it to the legislative council, who will draft it into an actual bill. And remember, as I just mentioned, there are limits to the number of bills that each member of the Senate or Assembly can introduce, so they have to be selective of which they want to represent. Because of the volume of bills being drafted, that responsibility is delegated to the Legislative Council, who essentially acts as legal counsel and is outside of the legislature. This person is elected every 2 years by all members of the legislature, which serves to ensure the nonpartisan nature of the role. After the bill is drafted, it's then introduced for its first reading in the house of its author. So if the author is a senator, it'll be first introduced in the Senate. And on the flip side, if the author is an assembly person, it'll first be introduced in the Assembly. The bill isn't yet up for discussion. They just read its number, its author, and its title. After this introduction, the bill has to be printed. So it's sent to yet another office. And this is my personal favorite office in the whole process, the Office of State Publishing. This office has a specific arm titled Legislative Bill Room, where all they do is print bills for the legislature. So welcome to 2024. We still have an entire office dedicated to printing things on paper for the government. Bills then wait 30 days until further action can be taken on them. And this waiting period is really meant to make the bill available to the public for review and investigation. And during this time, the public can contact their legislators about the bill. So people like you and me can call our legislative representatives and voice our thoughts on the bill before it moves forward in the process. After the bill is drafted, introduced, and printed, it then will move to the second step of the process, which is to be heard before all relevant committees. So as I mentioned earlier, each bill is assigned to an appropriate policy committee. And those assignments are made by either the Senate or Assembly Rules Committee. If you want to know more about the Rules Committee, I go into much more detail about it in my article, but all you really need to know is that they will assign the bill out for its presentation before the policy committee that most aligns with its subject matter. The purpose of the policy committee hearings is to be a forum for a smaller group of representatives than the entire House to dive deep into the policy implications of a certain bill. These are also forms for public input. So if you support a bill, you can testify before the committee on its behalf. Or alternatively, if you oppose a bill, you can voice your concerns. The bill is presented by the author, and then that testimony in support or opposition is given before the committee. The committee members will then vote to pass the bill, they can suggest amendments to the bill, or they can defeat the bill altogether. If bills have a fiscal impact or a state cost, the bill must also go through either the Senate or Assembly Appropriations Committee. These committees hear and consider fiscal considerations and budget impact rather than arguments on the basis of policy positions. So during these committee hearings, there's no testimony from bill authors. No proponents or opponents show up to voice their concerns. Really, the public is not involved in this portion of the process. They're simply voted on by committee members, and the Appropriations Committee can be pretty powerful because they can hold up or kill a bill really easily without giving any discussion or explanation. One example of how they could do this is through the suspense file. So when reviewing a bill for fiscal considerations, if a bill has a cost of $50,000 or more from the general fund or $150,000 or more to a special fund, the bill will automatically be placed in what's known as the suspense file. The committee can also place bills in the file that don't reach these certain thresholds of budget impacts just at their discretion. And we'll get to an example of that in a minute. The way that bills are moved out of the suspense file is through a vote-only suspense hearing, and this is held prior to the deadlines for fiscal committees to hear and report bills to the House floors. To give you an idea of just how powerful this is, in 2024, only 32% of bills that were in the suspense file made it out, and in prior years, it was an average of just 25%. Again, there's no testimony, there's no discussion, there's no reason given as to why the bill might be blocked from moving forward. This is an especially frustrating part of the process to bill authors, because again, they're not even given an explanation. Some see it as a way to shelve and even kill controversial bills, with the true reason being masked under fiscal considerations. So I found an interesting example of this happening to a bill that upon its drafting and introduction wasn't presented originally to have a fiscal impact. Assembly Bill 2408 was introduced in the 2021 to 2022 legislative session. This was a bill that would give prosecutors grounds to sue social media companies for addicting children to their platforms. And the subject matter of the bill isn't as important to what we're talking about as the fact that the bill wasn't intended to require funding or have an impact on the budget. The bill somehow ended up before the Senate Appropriations Committee, where it was shelved in the suspense file and then died during the vote-only suspense hearing. What's interesting is that the bill's author had no idea how the bill ended up before the Appropriations Committee in the first place. It was originally drafted in the Assembly, and it went through the entire process in the Assembly. And when it was presented to committees there, the Judiciary Committee included in their report that the bill would not have a fiscal impact. But then when the bill moved to the Senate, it was somehow determined that it would require the Department of Justice to add 5 new positions to take on the workload that the bill was introducing. But again, the author claimed that when working with the Attorney General, they never indicated they would need more positions or that it would significantly increase the workload. This is all meant to illustrate that this portion of the legislative process has a severe lack of transparency. And it has people on both sides of the political aisle calling for reform to prevent this from happening to more cases in the future. So if you're planning to introduce a bill anytime soon, you might want to ensure it doesn't have too much of a fiscal impact. But even if it has zero fiscal impact, it may not be safe if there are underlying motivations for certain representatives to want to bury it in appropriations. But if a bill is introduced, if it goes through policy committees as well as appropriation committees and survives to this point, it then moves on to the third step of the process, which is the verdict on the bill in its house of origin. So this is when the bill is read for the second time on the floor of the house that it was originated in. The purpose of this second reading is to introduce any changes that were made to adopt policy committee recommendations. Additionally, it gives the chance for further amendments to be made before the bill is up for vote. After the second reading, a bill analysis is prepared, and this explains the bill, it gives the current law, it gives the background, and it lists out organizations who support or oppose the bill. Then there's a third and final reading where the author fully explains the bill and the bill is up for discussion within the House. This is when it's presented for passage. A majority vote is required to pass, which means 21 votes in the Senate or 41 votes in the Assembly, unless the bill requires funding. Then there's a higher threshold. And so in that case, you would need 27 votes in the Senate or 54 votes in the Assembly. If a bill passes, now it's going to go to the other house. So let's say it passed in the Assembly. Now it would be sent over to the Senate, and the entire process is going to repeat in that other house. The other house has the power to make amendments to the bill. And so if amendments are made through the process and it's passed, then it would go back to the House of Origin for the amendments to be agreed upon. Ultimately, both the Senate and the Assembly have to pass the bill in order for it to reach the fifth and final step, which is when it goes to the governor's desk. When a bill goes to the governor, he has 12 days to sign the bill or to actively veto the bill. Bills will pass automatically in 12 days if they're not actively vetoed. Bills can pass without the governor's signature. This is known as approval without signing. And that usually would indicate that the governor didn't want to be associated with the bill for whatever political reason. It could prevent alienating certain constituents or interest groups who disagree with the bill. Governor Gavin Newsom hasn't taken this action during his time as governor, but former Governor Jerry Brown allowed 5 bills to become law without his signature during his time in office. And before him, Gray Davis also used this option for 5 bills. I was trying to look up examples to see why they might use this option. And so one example I found was Senate Bill 1272, which was a bill that sought to ask voters if the United States Constitution should be amended to overturn a previous court ruling. Jerry Brown was governor at the time, and he agreed with the precedent of the bill, meaning that he too thought that the court decision should be overturned and the United States Constitution amended. But he stated that the bill would have no legal effect. Even if it was passed, it wouldn't have legal authority to amend the U.S. Constitution. And so as such, he allowed the bill to pass, but he did so without his signature, saying, quote, "It is my intent to signal that I'm not inclined to repeat this practice of seeking advisory opinions from the voters." Based on how infrequently this has been used in the past couple of decades, it seems it isn't considered a popular option by governors. The bill could still be passed, but a 2/3 vote is required in both houses to override that veto. A governor's veto hasn't been overridden in California since 1980, so this is also an unlikely option statistically. If the governor passes the bill, it will go into effect as law the following January 1st. And at this point, the bill is final record. It's signed, it's dated, it's sent to the Secretary of State, and then it's given the official seal of the great state of California. And so at this point, you're probably wondering, where do I, as a voter, come into play? This process is how the legislature passes bills, but the votes of California citizens aren't required at any point. What we see on our ballots are not these bills that are introduced in the Senate or in the Assembly. What we vote on are known as ballot measures, and ballot measures are introduced by an entirely different process. This process is known as the ballot initiative process, and it was formalized in 1911 with the goal of putting the power of direct legislation into the hands of California's citizens so that it isn't only the legislature who can pass bills unchecked. Anyone, including you, can propose ballot measures through this process to be voted on by your fellow Californians. There are 3 types of ballot initiatives. There's first initiatives to create a new state law. There's initiatives to veto a state law that was passed through the legislative process, and then there's initiatives to amend the state constitution. What's really cool about this is that there are 24 states in the U.S. that don't have a state ballot initiative process at all. These are states like Tennessee, New York, Texas, Delaware, Hawaii, and so on. There are 11 states that do have a state ballot initiative process, but they don't allow all 3 types of ballot measures to be introduced by the people. For example, Idaho allows initiatives to create a new state law or to repeal a law passed through the legislature, but Idaho does not allow initiatives to amend the state constitution. On the opposite side, Florida allows initiatives for constitutional amendments, but they don't allow the introduction of new laws or to repeal laws passed by the legislature. California is one of just 15 states that gives its people the power to initiate all three types, alongside states like Oregon, Arizona, and Colorado. How cool is that? You live in a state that gives you direct power to pass legislation, to keep the legislature in check by repealing legislation, and to amend the constitution that you live under. I think it's super important then to know how the process works since we have the opportunity to be so involved. So, how do we get a ballot initiative on the ballot? Well, the process starts with a proponent drafting their proposition and submitting it to the Secretary of State with a fee. The proposal is then given a title, it's given a summary, they do a fiscal analysis of it, and then the Secretary of State approves it. At this point, it's sent back to the person who proposed the initiative, and their responsibility is to gather signatures for the initiatives to be approved and on the ballot. The required signatures have to be gathered within 180 days of it being approved by the Secretary of State, and they have to be submitted to the state to be verified within 131 days of the next election. The number of signatures that are required depends on both the type of initiative that it is and the year that it's being introduced in. And that's because it's actually a percentage based on the total number of votes for all candidates for governor in the last midterm election. So that will fluctuate every 4 years as there are gubernatorial races. For initiatives for a new law or to repeal an existing law, the percentage required is 5% of that total vote number. For constitutional amendments, the threshold's a little bit higher at 8% of the total vote number. If all the required signatures are gathered in the required time frame, the proposition will then qualify to be on the ballot and voted on in the upcoming election. And notice that I say it will qualify to be on the ballot and not that it's guaranteed to be on the ballot. Because another interesting note is that prior to 2014, it actually was guaranteed it would be on the ballot for the election. But after 2014, the process was amended so that proposed initiatives and amendments could be withdrawn before the election. This opened the door to an entirely new process where lawmakers will offer proponents of ballot initiatives to pass compromise legislation to avoid campaigning. During the process of getting to our current slate of propositions for this November ballot, 5 ballot measures have already been withdrawn or negotiated away after initially qualifying. The governor and lawmakers are involved in this process, and they can sometimes pressure proponents to remove their initiatives by offering them compromises. For example, there were 2 propositions qualified to be on our ballot in November that dealt with funding pandemic preparedness, as well as further funding for healthcare for children with critical illnesses. Governor Newsom made a deal with these proponents that if they pulled these measures off the ballot, he would expand in the state budget a state medical research program that would include both pandemic prevention and further funding for children's hospitals. And so as such, these 2 propositions were dropped and won't be voted on by voters in November. But regardless of this political jockeying, the power still ultimately lies with the proponents of the propositions. If they meet the qualifications through gathering the required signatures, their propositions can't be forced off the ballot. So what does all of this mean for you today? Well, walking through the legislative process has really made me even more convinced that we need to be informed, and really, we need to be voting. The process for introducing and passing legislation mostly sits with your representatives in the state assembly and the state senate. And so that means you need to know who these representatives are, and you need to vote for the ones who you believe will work to pass legislation that aligns with your values and with what's best for our state. But then there's also a reminder that the voice of the people ultimately keeps the legislature in check. While the legislative branch introduces and votes on bills, residents of the state can still be involved by testifying before committee hearings and by contacting the representatives in your district to make your support or opposition known. We also have the ability to directly get initiatives on ballots, and especially initiatives to repeal bills passed in the legislature that we may not have agreed with. This is important because no matter what bills are passed, all hope is not lost. If you're a conservative in California and you're looking at the Democratic supermajority in the legislature and in the governor's office and wondering if you can truly make a difference, all hope is not lost for you. Just because there are bills passed that you disagree with or that you believe will have negative outcomes the power still remains with the people. You can support groups that are working to repeal harmful legislation in the state. You can encourage your fellow citizens to vote on these measures. And additionally, even if you are a Democrat, you should still be informed about the legislation that's being passed because you might not agree with or support every bill introduced by representatives of your party. Going back to our first episode, just because someone has the same political party affiliation as you doesn't mean that you have to agree with every policy that they hold. So this is good news for conservatives and liberals alike, because if we're all using our common sense and thinking critically about the legislation being passed in our state, we can all be encouraged that we have some measure of direct impact and ability to hold our representatives accountable. So again, we'll work together to be informed about what has been passed in our state and what's up for our vote this November, and then we'll take action by actually voting and by supporting representatives and initiatives that align with our values and our vision for California. Additionally, another action item for you is to be on the lookout for future ballot initiatives that need signatures to be approved. Personally, there have been several times I've seen these groups collecting signatures for propositions outside of my local grocery store, my gym, our Target. I like to stop and take just a couple minutes to understand what these initiatives are and if they align with my values. And then if I agree with them, I take the time to put down my signature. This really helps those groups who are trying to use their direct power of legislation given to them by the California Constitution to create good laws and repeal bad ones. So I would encourage you, similarly, that the next time you see signatures being gathered, stop for just a moment. Try to understand if you want to support it or not. Specifically for the Christian, understanding the legislative and ballot initiative processes means that we can be specific when we pray for our state. We can be praying for representatives in both houses of the legislature who will have the wisdom and clarity on what will actually be good for the residents of California in line with God's standard of goodness. We can pray for bold voices to introduce ballot initiatives that will enact good legislation and repeal bad legislation. And we can also pray for common grace among our communities to recognize the importance of their vote and to take seriously understanding how proposed ballot measures will help or harm the people of California. You can find the status of active and inactive ballot initiatives on the California Attorney General's website, as well as the California Secretary of State's website. It's here that you can see how many are in process of gathering signatures, how many have reached a certain threshold of signatures, and which have been withdrawn or have failed to gather the required signatures in the time period. I'll put both of those links in the show notes for your future reference. Obviously, for this election, we're already past the 131 days before the election mark, so there are no further initiatives to qualify beyond the 10 slated to be on the ballot in November. But hopefully for the next election, you can keep an eye on initiatives being proposed and that need signatures to qualify. There are also a good statewide ballot initiative guide and suggested deadlines guide that I'll also link in the show notes as well for any of you who, in learning about this process, want to propose a ballot measure. The last note that I want to ask of you. As we start going through the propositions on the November ballot, I would suggest starting a note maybe on your phone or however you prefer to quickly and easily take notes and just jot down a few simple points about each proposition from week to week. I think that could be a really practical way for you to keep track of the main arguments for and against each proposition. And then it will be a good point of reference for you when it comes time to vote. We have to cover 10 propositions together, and they range in topics from crime to rent control to healthcare to taxes. At some point, it might be hard to keep in mind which you support, which you don't, and which you still have remaining questions on. But the whole point of this is to help you be informed come November. So that's just a simple recommendation for you as we dive into the weeds of all that's being proposed in our state. As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope it was informative, I hope it was helpful to you, and I hope that it could be a point of encouragement to you. If you're wondering what this podcast is all about, go back and listen to the first episode or check out more information on my website, thecaliforniaconversation.com. And if you are enjoying these episodes, I would ask that you would please subscribe to this podcast. You can follow me on social media at It's Tess Abraham, and please share the podcast with one fellow Californian who you think it could be a good resource for. I'll see you back here next week for another episode of The California Conversation.